Piven looked up to see concern written in Galet Jones's eyes. The expression instantly turned to anger.
"Will you two stop it? You're acting like children, like pre-sentient."
Iron Grip whirled and pointed at her.
"What do you know about it, huh? Are you some sort of expert? Are you a member of the goddamn Uplift Board? Are you even a mother yet?"
"I'm a student of galactic sociology,"
Galet said rather stiffly. Iron Grip laughed bitterly.
"A title given to reward a clever monkey. You must have really done some beautiful tricks on the jungle gym to get a real-as-life scale model sheepskin doctorate."
He crouched near her.
"Haven't you figured it out yet, little miss? Let me spell it for you. We're all goddamn presentients. Go ahead, deny it. Tell me I'm wrong."
It was Galet's turn to change color. She glanced at Fibbin, and he knew she was remembering that afternoon at the college in Port Helena when they had climbed to the top of the bell tower and looked out over a campus empty of humans, filled only with Chim students and Chim faculty, trying to act as if nothing had changed. She had to be remembering how bitter it had been, seeing that scene as a galactic would.
"I'm a sapient being,"
she muttered, obviously trying to put conviction into her voice.
"Yeah,"
Iron Grip sneered.
"What you mean to say, though, is that you're just a little closer than the rest of us. Closer to what the Uplift Board defines as a target for us Neo-Chims. Closer to what they think we ought to be. Tell me, though, what if you took a space trip to Earth and the captain took a wrong turn onto D-level hyperspace and you arrived a couple of 100 years from now? What do you think would happen to your precious white card then?"
Galet looked away.
"Sic transit gloria mundi."
Iron Grip snapped his fingers.
"You'd be a relic then, obsolete, a phase, long bypassed in the relentless progress of Uplift."
He laughed, reaching out and taking her chin in his hand to make her meet his eyes.
"You'd be probationer, honey."
Fibbin surged forward, but was caught short by his chains. The jolting stop sent pain shooting up from his right wrist, but in his anger, Fibbin hardly noticed. He was too filled with wrath to be able to speak. Dimly, as he snarled at the other chin, he knew that the same held for Galet. It was all the more infuriating because it was just one more proof that the bastard was right. Iron Grip met Fibbin's gaze for a long moment before letting go of Galet.
"100 years ago, he went on, "I would have been something special. They would have forgiven, ignored my own little quirks and drawbacks. They'd have given me a white card for my cunning and my strength. Time is what decides it, my good little Chen and Chimmy. It's all what generation you're born in."
He stood up straight.
"Or is it?"
Iron Grip smiled.
"Maybe it also depends on who your patrons are, If the standards change, if the target image of the ideal future Pons Sapiens changes, well..."
He spread his hands, letting the implication sink in. Galet was the first to find her voice.
"You actually expect the Gubru?"
Iron Grip shrugged.
"Times are a-changin', my darlings. I may yet have more grandkids than either of you."
Fibbin found a key to drive out the incapacitating anger and unlock his own voice. He laughed. He guffawed.
"Yeah?"
he asked, grinning.
"Well, First, you'll have to fix your other problem, boyo. How are you going to pass on your genes if you can't even get it up to...
This time, it was Iron Grip's unshod foot that lashed out. Pippin was more prepared and rolled aside to take the kick at an angle, but more blows followed in a dull rain. There were no more words, though, and a quick glance told Pippin that it was Iron Grip's turn to be tongue-tied. Low sounds emerged as his mouth opened and closed, flecked with foam. Finally, in frustration, the tall Chim gave up kicking at Pippin. He swiveled and stomped out. The Chimmy with the keys watched him go. She stood by the door, looking uncertain what to do. Pippin grunted as he rolled over onto his back.
Ah!
He winced as he felt his ribs. None seemed to be broken.
At least Simon Legree wasn't able to perform a proper exit line. I half expected him to say, "I'll be back, just you wait," or something equally original.
Galet shook her head.
"What do you gain by baiting him?"
He shrugged.
"I got my reasons."
Gingerly he backed against the wall. The Chimmy in the billowing zip suit was watching him, but when their eyes met, she quickly blinked and turned to leave, closing the door behind her. Pippin lifted his head and inhaled deeply through his nose several times.
"Now what are you doing?"
Galen asked. He shook his head.
"Nothing, just passing the time."
When he looked again, Galet had turned her back to him again. She seemed to be crying.
Small surprise, Pippin thought.
It probably wasn't as much fun for her being a prisoner as it had been leading a rebellion. For all the two of them knew, the resistance was washed up, finished, kaput, and there wasn't any reason to believe things had gone any better in the mountains. Athaclena and Robert and Benjamin might be dead or captured by now. Port Helena was still ruled by birds and quislings.
"Don't worry," he said, trying to cheer her up. "You know what they say about the truest test of sapiency? You mean you haven't heard of it? Why, it's just coming through when the chimps are down."
Galet wiped her eyes and turned her head to look at him.
"Oh, shut up," she said. "Okay, so it's an old joke,"
Pippin admitted to himself.
"But it was worth a try."
Still, she motioned for him to turn around.
"Come on, it's your turn." "Maybe,"
she smiled weakly, as if uncertain whether or not to try a joke of her own.
"Maybe I can find something to snack on, too."
Pippin grinned. He shuffled about and stretched his chains until his back was as close to her as possible, not minding how it strained his various hurts. He felt her hands working to unknot his tangled furry thatch, and rolled his eyes upward.
"Ah! Ah!"
he sighed. A different jailer brought them their noon meal, a thin soup accompanied by two slices of bread. This male Proby possessed none of Iron Grip's fluency. In fact, he seemed to have trouble with even the simplest phrases, and snarled when Pippin tried to draw him out. His left cheek twitched intermittently in a nervous tic, and Galet whispered to Pippin that a feral glint in the Chim's eyes made her nervous. Pippin tried to distract her.
"Tell me about Earth," he asked. "What's it like?"
Galet used a bread crust to sop up the last of her soup.
"What's to tell? Everybody knows about Earth."
"Yeah, from video and from Go There Cube book, sure. But not from personal experience. You went as a child with your parents, didn't you? That's where you got your doctorate?"
She nodded.
"University of Jakarta."
And then what?
Her gaze was distant.
Then I applied for a position at the Tarragon Center for Galactic Studies in La Paz.
Bibbon knew of the place. Many of Earth's diplomats, emissaries, and agents took training there, learning how the ancient cultures of the five galaxies thought and acted. It was crucial if the leaders were to plan a way for the three races of Earth to make their way in a dangerous universe. Much of the fate of the Wolfling clan depended on the graduates of the CGS.
"I'm impressed you even applied," he said, meaning it. Did you pass?
She nodded.
It was close. I qualified. Barely. If I'd scored just a little better, they said there'd have been no question.
Obviously, the memory was painful. She seemed undecided, as if tempted to change the subject. Galet shook her head.
"Then I was told that they'd prefer it if I returned to Garth instead. I should take up a teaching position," they said. "They made it plain I'd be more useful here."
"They? Well, who's this they you're talking about?"
Galet nervously picked at the fur on the back of her arm. She noticed what she was doing and made both hands lay still on her lap.
"The uplift board,"
she said quietly.
But what do they have to say about assigning teaching positions or influencing career choices, for that matter?
She looked at him.
"They have a lot to say, Fibbon, if they think Neo-Chimp or Neo-Dolphin genetic progress is at stake. They can keep you from becoming a spacer, for instance, out of fear your precious plasm might get irradiated. Or they can prevent you from entering chemistry as a profession, out of fear of unpredicted mutations."
She picked up a piece of straw and twirled it slowly.
"Oh, we have a lot more rights than other young client races, I know that. I keep reminding myself." "But they decided your genes were needed on Garth,"
Fibbon guessed in low voice. She nodded.
"There's a point system. If I'd really scored well on the CGS exam, it would have been okay. A few chims do get in. But I was at the margin. Instead, they presented me with that damned white card, like it was some sort of consolation prize or maybe a wafer for some sacrament, and they sent me back to my native planet. Back to poor old Garth. Seems my raison d'etre is the babies I'll have. Everything else is incidental."
She laughed, somewhat bitterly.
"Hell, I've been breaking the law for months now, risking my life and womb in this rebellion. Even if we'd have won, fat chance, I could get a big fat medal from the TAASF, maybe even ticker tape parades, and it wouldn't matter. When all the hoopla died down, I'd still be thrown into prison by the uplift board."
"Oh, good all," Fibbon sighed, sagging back against the cool stones. "But you haven't, you haven't yet,
haven't procreated yet?" "Good observation. One of the few advantages of being a female with a white card is that I can choose anyone blue or higher for the father, and pick my own timing, so long as I have three or more offspring before I'm 30. I don't even have to raise them myself."
Again came the sharp, bitter laugh.
"Hell, half of the Chim marriage groups on Garth would shave themselves bald for the right to adopt one of my kids."
"She makes her situation sound so awful,"
Fibbon thought.
"And yet there must be fewer than 20 other Chims on the planet, regarded as highly by the born. To a member of a client race, it's the highest honor."
Still, maybe he understood after all. She would have come home to Garth knowing one fact, that no matter how brilliant her career, how great her accomplishments, it would only make her ovaries all the more valuable, only make more frequent the painful, invasive visits to the plasm bank, and only bring on more pressure to carry as many as possible to term in her own womb. Invitations to join group marriages or pair bonds would be automatic, easy. Too easy. There would be no way to know if a group wanted her for herself. Lone male suitors would seek her for the status fathering her child would bring. And then there would be the jealousy. He could empathize with that. Jims weren't often very subtle at hiding their feelings, especially envy. Quite a few would be downright mean about it.
Iron Grip was right, Gaylet said. It's got to be different for a Chen. A white card would be fun for a male Chim, I can see that. But for a Chimmy? One with ambition to be something for herself?
She looked away.
I...
Piven tried to think of something to say, but for a moment all he could do was sit there feeling thick-headed, stupid. Perhaps someday one of his great, to-the-nth grandchildren would be smart enough to know the right words, to know how to comfort someone too far gone into bitterness, even to want comforting any more. That more fully uplifted Neo-Chim, a few score more generations down the chain of uplift, might be bright enough. But Fibbon knew he wasn't. He was only an ape.
Oh, he coughed. I remember a time back on Silmar Island, it must have been before you returned to Garth. Let's see, was it 10 years ago? Ifni. I think I was just a freshman. He sighed. Anyway, the whole island got all excited that year when Igor Patterson came to lecture and perform at the university.
Gaylet's head lifted a little.
Igor Patterson, the drummer?
Fibbon nodded.
So you've heard of him?
She smirked sarcastically.
Who hasn't? He's...
Gaylet spread her hands and let them drop, palms up.
He's wonderful.
That summed it up all right, for Igor Patterson was the best. The Thunder Dance was only one aspect of the Neo-Chimpanzee's love affair with rhythm. Percussion was a favorite musical form, from the quaint farmlands of Hermes to the sophisticated towers of Earth. Even in the early days, back when Chims had been forced to carry keyboard displays on their chests in order to speak at all, even then, the new race had loved the beat. And yet, all of the great drummers on Earth and in the colonies were humans, everyone. Until Igor Patterson. He was the first. The first Chim with the fine finger coordination, the delicacy of timing, the sheer chutzpah to make it alongside the best. Listening to Patterson play Clash Ceramic Lightning wasn't only to experience pleasure. For Chim, it was to burst with pride. To many, his mere existence meant that Chims weren't just approaching what the Uplift Board wanted them to be, but what they wanted to be as well.
The Carter Foundation sent him on a tour of the colonies, Fibbon went on. Partly it was a goodwill trip for all the outlying Chim communities, and of course it was also to spread the good luck around a bit.
Gaylet snorted at the obviousness of it. Of course Patterson had a white card. The Chim members of the Uplift Board would have insisted, even if he weren't also as wonderfully charming, intelligent, and handsome a specimen of Neo-Chimpanzee as anyone could ask to meet. And Fibbon thought he knew what else Gaylet was thinking. For a male, having a white card wouldn't be much of a problem at all. Just one long party.
I'll bet, she said,
and Fibbon imagined he detected a clear tone of envy.
Yeah, well, you should have been there when he showed up to give his concert. I was one of the lucky ones. My seat was way up and back, out of the way, and it happened that I had a real bad cold that night. That was damn fortunate.
What?
Galet's eyebrows came together.
What does that have to do with...
Oh.
She frowned at him and her jaw tightened.
Oh, I see.
I'll bet you do. The air conditioning was set on high, but I'm told the aroma was still overpowering. I had to sit shivering under the blowers. Damn near caught my death.
Will you get to the point?
Galet's lips were a thin line.
Well, as no doubt you've guessed, nearly every green or blue-card chimney on the island who happened to be in Estrus seemed to have a ticket to the concert. None of them used Ulfa spray. They came, generally, with the complete okay of their group husbands, wearing flaming pink lipstick. Just on the off chance.
I get the picture,
Galet said. And for just an instant, Fibbon wondered if he saw her blink back a faint smile as she pictured the scene. If so, it was only a momentary flicker of her severe frown.
So what happened?
Fibbon stretched, yawning.
What would you expect to happen?
A riot, of course. Her jaw dropped.
Really? At the university?
Sure as I'm sitting here.
But
all the first few minutes went all right. Man, old Igor could play as good as his rep, I'll tell you. The crowd kept getting more and more excited. Even the backup band was feeling it. Then things kind of got out of hand.
But
remember old Professor Olfing from the Terrigan's Traditions Department? You know, the elderly chim who sports a monocle? Used to spend his spare time lobbying to get a chim monogamy bill before the legislature?
Yes, I knew him.
She nodded, her eyes wide open. Fibbon made a gesture with two hands.
No. In public? Professor Olfley?
With the dean of the College of Frigging Nutrition, no less.
Galet let out a sharp sound. She turned aside, hand to her breast. She seemed to suffer a sudden bout of hiccups.
Of course, Olfing's pair-bond wife forgave him later. It was that or lose him to a 10 group that said they liked his style.
Galet slapped her chest, coughing. She turned further away from Fibbon, shaking her head vigorously.
Poor Igor Patterson,
Fibbon continued.
He had problems of his own, of course. Some of the guys from the football team had been drafted as bouncers. When it started getting out of hand, they tried using fire extinguishers. That made things slippery, but it didn't slow him down much.
Galet coughed louder.
Fibbon!
It was too bad, really, he mused aloud. Igor was getting into a great blues riff, really pounding no skins, packing in a backbeat you couldn't believe. I was grooving on it, until this 40-year-old chimmy, naked and slick as a dolphin, dropped straight onto him from the rafters.
Galet doubled over, clutching her belly. She held up a hand, pleading for mercy.
Stop, please,
she whimpered weakly.
Thank heavens it was the snare drum she fell through. Took her long enough getting untangled for poor Igor to escape out the back way, just barely ahead of the mob.
She toppled over sideways. For a moment Fibbon felt concern. Her face was so flushed and red. She hooted, slapping the floor, and tears streamed from her eyes. Galet rolled over onto her back, rocking with peals of laughter. Fibbon shrugged.
And all that was just from playing the first number. Patterson's special version of the bloody national anthem. What a pity. I never did get to hear his variation on Inagata Davida. Now that I think about it, though,
He sighed once more.
Maybe it's just as well.
Power curfew came at 2000 hours, and no exception was made for prisons. A wind had risen before sunset and soon was rattling the shutters of their small window. It came in off the ocean, carrying a heavy salt smell. In the distance could be heard the faint rumblings of an early summer storm. They slept, curled in their blankets, as close to each other as their chains allowed, head to head, so they could hear each other breathing in the darkness. They slumbered, inhaling the soft tang of stone and the mustiness of straw, and exhaled the soft mutterings of their dreams. Gaylet's hands moved in tiny jerks, as if trying to follow the rhythms of some illusory escape. Her chains tinkled faintly. Vibin lay motionless, but now and then he blinked, his eyes occasionally opening and closing without the light of consciousness in them. Sometimes a breath caught and held for a long moment, before releasing at last. They did not notice the low humming sound that penetrated from the hallway outside, nor the light which speared into their cell through cracks in the wooden door. Feet shuffled, and claws clicked on flagstones. When the keys rattled in the lock, Fibbin jerked, rolled to one side, and sat up. He knuckled his eyes as the hinges creaked. Gaylet lifted her head. She used her hand to block the sharp glare of two lamps held high on poles. Fibbin sneezed, smelling lavender and feathers. When he and Gaylet were hauled to their feet by several of the zip-suited chims, he recognized the gruff voice of their head captor, Iron Grip.
You two better behave yourselves. You've got important visitors.
Fibbin blinked, trying to adjust to the light. At last he made out a small crowd of feathered quadrupeds, large balls of white fluff bedecked in ribbons and sashes. Two of them held staffs from which the bright lanterns hung. The rest twittered around what looked like a short pole ending in a narrow platform. On that perch stood a most singular-looking bird. It, too, was arrayed in bright ribbons. The large bipedal gubru shifted its weight from one leg to another nervously. It might have been the way the light struck the alien's plumage, but the coloration seemed richer, more luminous than the normal off-white shade. It reminded Fibbin of something as if he had seen this invader or one like it before somewhere.
What the hell is the thing doing, moving around at night?
Fibbin wondered.
I thought they hated to do that.
Pay proper respect to honored elders, members of the high clan Guxiu Gubru,
Iron Grip said sharply, nudging Fibbin.
I'll show the damn thing my respect.
Fibbin made a rude sound in his throat and gathered phlegm.
No,
Gaylet cried. She grabbed his arm and whispered urgently.
Fibbin, don't, please. Do this for me. Act exactly as I do.
Her brown eyes were pleading. Fibbin swallowed.
Oh, hell, Gaylet.
She turned back toward the Gubru and folded her arms across her chest. Fibbin imitated her, even as she bowed low. The Galactic peered at them, first with one large, unblinking eye, then another. It shuffled to one end of the perch, forcing its holders to adjust their balance. Finally, it began chirping in a series of sharp, clipped squawks. From the quadrupeds there emerged a strange, swooping accompaniment, rising and falling, sounding something like zoon. One of the Kwaku servitors ambled forward. A bright metallic disc hung from a chain around its neck. The Vodor gave forth a low, jerky, Anglic translation.
It has been judged in honor, judged in propriety, that you two have not transgressed, have not broken,
the rules of conduct, the rules of war. Zun. We judge that it is right, proper, meet to allow for infant status, to charitably credit, believe, that your struggles were on your patron's behalf. Zun. It comes to our attention, awareness, knowledge, that your status is, as leaders of your gene flux, race flow, species in this place and time. Zun. We therefore offer, present, deign to honor you with an invitation, a blessing, a chance to earn the boon of representation. Zun. It is an honor, beneficence, glory to be chosen, to seek out, penetrate, create the future of your race. Zun. There it finished as abruptly as it had begun.
Bow again,
Galet urged in a whisper. He bent over with arms crossed as she demonstrated. When Fibbon looked up again, the small crowd of alien avians had swiveled and moved toward the doorway. The perch was lowered, but still the tall Gubru had to duck down, feathered arms splayed apart for balance, in order to pass through. Iron Grip followed behind. The probationer's parting glare at them was one of pure loathing. Bibbon's head rang. He had given up trying to follow the bird's queer, formal dialect of Galactic 3 after the first phrase. Even the Anglic translation had been well nigh impossible to understand. The sharp lighting faded as the procession moved away down the hallway in a babble of clucking gabble. In the remaining dimness, Fibbon and Galet turned and looked at each other.
"Now, who the hell was that?" he asked.
Galet frowned.
"It was a suzerain, one of their three leaders. If I'm not wrong, and I could easily be, it was the suzerain of propriety."
"That tells me a whole lot. Just what on Ifni's roulette wheel is a suzerain of propriety?"
Galet waved away his question. Her forehead was knotted in deep concentration.
"Why did it come to us, instead of having us brought to it?"
she wondered aloud, though obviously she wasn't soliciting his opinion.
"And why meet us at night? Did you notice it didn't even stay to hear if we accepted its offer? It probably felt compelled by propriety to make it in person, but its aides can get our answer later."
"Answer? To what? What offer? Galet, I couldn't even follow—"
But she made a nervous waving motion with both hands.
"Not now. I've got to think, Fibbon. Give me a few minutes."
She walked back to the wall and sat down on the straw, facing the blank stone. Fibbon had a suspicion it would be considerably longer than she'd estimated before she was done.
"You can sure choose 'em," he thought. "You deserve what you get when you fall in love with a genius."
He blinked, shook his head.
"Say what?"
But movement in the hall distracted him from pursuing his own unexpected thought. A solitary chim entered, carrying an armload of straw and folded bolts of dark brown cloth. The load hid the short neo-chimp's face. Only when she lowered it to the ground did Fibbon see that it was the chimmy who had stared at him earlier, the one who seemed so strangely familiar.
"I brought you some fresh straw and some more blankets. These nights are still pretty cool."
He nodded.
"Thank you."
She did not meet his eyes. She turned and walked back toward the door, moving with a lithe grace that was obvious, even under the billowing zip suit.
"Wait,"
he said suddenly. She stopped, still facing the door. Fibbon walked toward her as far as the heavy chains would allow.
"What's your name?"
he asked softly, not wanting to disturb Galet in her corner. Her shoulders were hunched. She still faced away from him. Her voice was very low.
Some people call me Sylvie.
Even in swirling quickly through the doorway, she moved like a dancer. There was a rattle of keys, and hurried footsteps could be heard receding down the hall outside. Fibbin stared at the blank door.
Well, I'll be a monkey's grandson.
He turned around and walked back to the wall where Galet sat, muttering to herself, and leaned over to drape a blanket upon her shoulders. Then he returned to his own corner to collapse into a heap of sweet-smelling straw. Chapter 55 Utha Calding. Scummy algae formed in the shadows where a few small, stilt-legged native birds picked desultorily for insects. Bushy plants lay in clumps, outlining the surrounding steps. Footprints led from the banks of the small lake up into the nearby scrub-covered hillside. Just glancing at the muddy tracks, Utha Calding could tell that the walker had stepped with a pigeon-toed gait. It seemed to use a three-legged stance. He looked up quickly as a flash of blue caught the corner of his eye, the same glimmer that had led him to this place. He tried to focus on the faint twinkle, but it was gone before he could track it. He knelt to examine the impressions in the mud. A smile spread as he measured them with his hands. Such beautiful outlines. The third foot was off-center from the other two, and its print was much smaller than the others, almost as if some bipedal creature had crossed from lake to brush, leaning on a blunt-headed staff. Utha Calding picked up a fallen branch, but he hesitated before brushing away the outlines.
"Shall I leave them?" he wondered. "Is it really necessary to hide them?"
He shook his head.
"No, as the humans say, do not change game plans in midstream."
The footprints disappeared as he swept the branch back and forth. Just as he was finishing, he heard heavy footsteps and the sound of breaking shrubs behind him. He turned as Colt rounded a bend in the narrow game trail to the small prairie lake. The glyph Lururanu hovered and darted over the Thenanin's big crested head, like some frustrated parasitic insect, buzzing about in search of a soft spot that never seemed to be there. Utha Calding's corona ached like an overused muscle. He let Lururanu bounce against Colt's bluff stolidity for a minute longer before admitting defeat. He drew the defeated glyph back in and dropped the branch to the ground. The Thenanin wasn't looking at the terrain anyway. His concentration was on a small instrument resting in his broad palm.
"I am growing suspicious, my friend," Colt said as he drew even with the Timbrimi.
Utha Calding felt blood rush in the arteries at the back of his neck.
"Last?" he wondered. "Suspicious of what, my colleague?"
Colt folded an instrument and put it away in one of his many vest pouches.
"There are signs." His crest flapped. "I have been listening to the uncoded transmissions of the Gubru, and something odd seems to be going on."
Utha Calding sighed. No, Colt's one-track mind was concentrating on a completely different subject. There was no use trying to draw him away from it with subtle clues.
"What are the invaders up to now?"
he asked.
"Well, first of all, I am picking up much less excited military traffic.
and suddenly they appear to be engaged in fewer of those small-scale fights up in the mountains than they were days and weeks ago. You'll recall, we were both wondering why they were expending so much effort to suppress what had to be a rather tiny partisan resistance. Actually, Uther Calding had been pretty certain he knew the reason for the frantic flurry of activity on the part of the Gubru. From what the two of them had been able to piece together, it seemed the invaders were very anxious to find something up in the mountains of Mulan. They had thrown soldiers and scientists into the rough range with apparent reckless energy, and appeared to have paid a heavy cost for the effort.
"Can you think of a reason why the fighting has ebbed?"
he asked Kalt. "I am uncertain from what I can decipher. One possibility is that the Gubru have found and captured the thing they were so desperately looking for."
"Doubtful," Uther Calding thought with conviction. "It is hard to cage a ghost."
"Or they may have given up searching for it."
"More likely,"
Uther Calding agreed. It was inevitable that sooner or later the avians should realize they had been made fools of and cease chasing wild gooses. "Or perhaps," Kalt concluded, "the Gubru have simply finished suppressing all opposition and liquidated whoever was opposing them." Uther Calding prayed the last answer was not the correct one. It was among the risks he had taken, of course, in arranging to tease the enemy into such a frenzy. He could only hope that his daughter and Megan Oneagle's son had not paid the ultimate price to further his own convoluted hoax on the malign birds.
"Hmm,"
he commented.
"Did you say there was something else puzzling you?"
"This," Kalt went on, "that after 5/12 of planetary days, during which they have done nothing at all for the benefit of this world, suddenly the Gubru are making announcements, offering amnesty and employment to former members of the Ecological Recovery Service."
"Yes. Well, maybe it just means they've completed their consolidation and can now spare a little attention to their responsibilities."
Kalt snorted. "Perhaps, but the Gubru are accountants, credit counters, humorless, selfish warriors. They are fanatically prim about those aspects of galactic tradition that interest them. Yet they hardly seem to care at all about preserving planets as nursery worlds, only about the near-term status of their clan." Although Uther Calding agreed with that assessment, he considered Kalt less than an impartial observer, and the Thenanin was hardly the one to accuse others of being humorless. Anyway, one thing was obvious. So long as Kalt was distracted like this, thinking about the Gubru, it would be useless to try to draw his attention to subtle clues and footprints in the ground. He could sense movement in the prairie all around him. The little carnivores and their prey were all seeking cover, settling into small niches and burrows to wait out midday, when the fierce heat of summer would beat down, and it would cost too much energy either to give chase or to flee. In that respect, tall galactics were no exception.
"Come," Uther Calding said. "The sun is high. We must find a shady place to rest. I see some trees over on the other side of the water."
Kalt followed without comment. He appeared to be indifferent about minor deviations in their path, so long as the distant mountains grew perceptibly closer each day. The white-topped peaks were now more than just a faint line against the horizon. It might take weeks to reach them, and indeterminably longer to find a way through unknown passes to the Sind. But Thenanin were patient when it suited their purposes. There were no blue glimmerings, as Uther Calding found them shelter under a too-tight cluster of stunted trees, though he kept his eye peeled anyway. Still, with his corona, he thought he kenned a touch of feral joy from some mind hiding out there on the step, something large, clever, and familiar.